Thank you, Wes and Cheyenne. Appreciate that. And another very good song. It has a lot of good meaning. And there's certainly nothing truer than, you know, God is a good father. It goes right into an announcement I forgot to make. I talked to Forrest last night, and he gave me an update on the kids, and they're doing very well. And again, you know, as you know the situation there, you know that there's absolutely no question that God has been involved. His hand's been involved in the whole thing. So, you know, they are still healing, and it'll take a little while yet, but overall they're doing very, very well, and please do continue to keep the whole family in your prayers. Appreciate that very much. You know, there once was four friends who absolutely enjoyed and thrived on meditation. It's not a bad thing. Meditation's a good thing. But one day, they decided to take it up a notch. Take it up another to another level. They decided that they would get together and all four of his friends would meditate for 7 days. 7 days. That's a lot of meditation. So they each vowed amongst themselves that in those 7 days they would not say one word. They wouldn't talk. They would just meditate. Well, since they wouldn't be speaking, they decided that it would be wise if all four of them to get together and hire an assistant. You know, if they're not going to be talking, they need somebody to do their routines, their go-tos, whatever they needed. So they did this. They hired this assistant. Well, their silence began very early the next day. And although they did not speak at all, the entire day went pretty fast. You know, the first day was gone, and they had no problems. Everything went good. They maintained their vow of silence, if you will. Well, that evening, the assistant lit a lamp for them. You know, they didn't want to sit in the dark. But as time passed, the oil started going down, and the lamp started to go out. The assistant was not paying attention. The assistant was somewhere else. Well, seeing this, the first friend had absolutely all they could take. So the first friend shouted out, "Attend the lamp!" One day into it. Well, listening to this, the second friend said, "Have you forgotten? You are not supposed to speak." There's two down. Well, just then, the third friend piped up and said, "You crazy people, we're not talking." Strike three. The last friend, sitting there, went, "Huh. I'm the only one that can keep silent." Well, there's a moral. The moral to this story is we sometimes judge very quickly, forgetting that we too are not perfect in our actions or our behaviors. I want to share with you one more story. This was a young couple, and they moved into a new neighborhood. They were newly wedded. The next morning, while they were eating breakfast at the table, the young woman, she looked out the window and she saw her neighbor hanging out the wash. She said, "That laundry, it's not very clean. It needs some help. Maybe she doesn't know how to do laundry correctly. Perhaps she needs better laundry soap." Her husband looked on and he didn't say anything. Early the next morning, or the next week, it was a week later, she did laundry again, and the same thing happened. She looked out the window, and she said, "Man, this is starting to really aggravate me. This woman does not know how to do laundry. Somebody's got to say something to her." Well, nothing happened. And about a month later, they were sitting at their table again on a sunny morning, and the woman looked out, and she said, "Wow, look at this. She finally figured out how to do laundry. Look how clean her laundry is. It's beautiful." Her husband looked up and said, "Yeah, I got up early this morning and I washed your windows." The point is, we can't be too quick to judge others. That's the point. Especially if our perspective of life is clouded by anger, by jealousy, by negativity, or even unfulfilled desires. The subject of judgment and judging, it often seems very difficult to grasp. You know, we're conflicted. Do we do it? Do we not do it? How do we do it? If we are supposed to do it, you know, there's a whole laundry list of questions. There's very, very many opinions on the subject of judgment. You think about this. Albert Einstein once said this. He said, if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing it is stupid. When I first read that, I thought, But then I got thinking about it. That makes sense. If you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it's stupid. I want you to turn over to Matthew chapter 7 to start. Matthew chapter 7, and we'll look at verse 1 here. Very simple statement. Christ made this statement. Matthew chapter 7, verse 1 says, judge not that you be not judged. And a lot of times, that is the end of the story. That's where we leave it. Some use the term judge in a generalized way, making assertions such as we shouldn't judge another for anything. So my question is that true? Is that true? We just read here in Matthew chapter 7, Christ himself said, judge not that you be not judged. Think about that for a minute. If we took the idea of not judging anybody for anything, if we took that to an extreme, we would not be able to make any evaluations at all whether a person's conduct is acceptable to God, to society in general, or even to ourselves. So there seems to be a conflict here. Such a totally non-judgmental atmosphere, if that's what we choose, it would generate such things as tolerance. Now, I use that very careful, because we are supposed to be tolerant, but we are not supposed to be tolerant of sin. You see where we're going here? If we take a society and we accept everything and we accept tolerance of everything, then it would be a very hazardous society to live in. Nothing would be called into question. Nothing would be wrong. God never intended that this be the case when Christ said, judge not that you be not judged in Matthew 7 verse 1. So again, if it was taken to an extreme, a person's example, whether good or bad, would have absolutely no power to influence behavior of another. Think about our calling, what we're called to do. Didn't Christ say we're supposed to live an example? So now again, we're starting to see, well, this is the other side of the coin. So we'll go a little deeper. Before determining whether we want to imitate or even reject how another person acts, guess what? We have to evaluate. It's a fancy word for judge. We have to evaluate. We have to judge. We have to judge those individuals' conduct. Is it godly? Is it law-abiding? I'd like to take some time again to hopefully clear up some of these maybe contradictions, the seeming contradictions. They're not, because the Bible doesn't contradict itself, and we'll see that here before we're done. But maybe some misunderstandings that we might have, and hopefully we can gain some clarity on this subject of judging and judgment. So first we see that judgment is a noun form of the verb to judge. According to Webster's New World Dictionary, it means this: a legal decision, an order, a decree, or sentence given by a judge or a court of law. This has a number of biblical applications and very practical ramifications regarding our conduct, both in and out of the church. Another facet of judgment is, and I quote this, the ability to come to opinions about things, power of comparing and deciding. In this meaning, synonyms include discernment. Isn't that a very strong biblical term? How about good sense? How about wise decisions? All these come from the ability of you and I to judge and judge correctly. But is that really the word we want to use? Judge correctly? Well, we'll get into that in just a minute too. In a circumstance in which there was no specific law that existed, judgments are usually made on the basis of previously existing laws or ordinances or principles. And a very good one to look at is back in Numbers chapter 27. This is a clear example here, and it involves the daughter of Zelophehad. Numbers chapter 27. We'll read a few verses here. Kind of see what the story is about here. We'll start in verse 1, but I'm going to skip down through 2 through 11, actually. So in verse 1 here, it says, "Then came the daughters of Zelophehad," and then it goes on to tell about his lineage and all that. I'm going to skip that, but in verse 2, "And they stood before Moses, before Eleazar, the priest, and before the leaders of all the congregation by the doorway of the tabernacle of meetings, saying, Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord in company with Korah, but he died in his own sin. And he had no sons." And this is where the problem comes in. Then he goes on to say, "Why should the name of our father be removed from among the family because he had no sons? Give us possessions among our father's brother." So Moses brought their case before the Lord. So see, there was no son for the inheritance, the name to be passed on. So they're bringing this up. "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, The daughters of Zelophehad speaks what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers, and cause the inheritance of their fathers to pass to them. And you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, If a man dies and has no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if the father has no brothers, then you shall give the inheritance to the relative closest to him in the family. And he shall possess it. And it shall come to pass, to the children of Israel, a statute of judgment, just as the Lord commanded Moses." All that, in a way, of talking about judgments, how judgments come to be and what they're used for. And here we see a whole new line of order of things that was brought up and created simply because an issue came up or a problem came up. So guess what? They had to look, review, evaluate, and then make a judgment. Well, that's not so different than what you and I do with individuals. So here Zelophehad died. He left 5 daughters, but no sons. Israel had no specific inheritance law covering such a circumstance, and Moses did not know what to do. So he took it to God and received a judgment. From that point on, the judgment became a law in the land. God used existing principles involved the closeness of blood relationships here to establish a progressive sequence to cover the inheritance, what we're talking about here. He also employed all of the above definitions here that we talked about. He understood the circumstances, and think about this. He compared the various existing principles with the new situation, and he very wisely made a decree covering specific instance, a judgment. Without a doubt, it became a precedent for subsequent cases. So, judging is an act. It's the process, if you will, of seeing, hearing, reading, sifting, calculating, reckoning, comparing, and evaluating. evidence for reaching or determining an opinion or a decision. That's a lot of words to say. It comes to discernment. It is one of the most commonly occurring acts in our life. In a wide variety of situations, we perform this process many, many times a day. And a lot of times we might not even think about what we're doing. But this is what we're doing. We do it so frequently and automatically that we rarely stop to consciously think of the amount of evaluations that we are making in comparing, you know, whatever it might be, quality, cost, value, safety, danger, ethics, morality. The list goes on. But don't we run these through our mind almost every day? To one aspect or another, we do. From the time that we get up in the morning to begin the day, our minds are processing information. And it's doing this to determine what we should do, where we should go, how we should act, who we should talk to, how we should talk to them. And the question is, how do we do this? How well do we do this? Do we do it in complete alignment with God? The process of judging leads to very, very personal judgments, which in reality are and become the beliefs, the opinions, the preferences, and even the convictions behind every choice that you and I make on a daily basis. You didn't know our lives were that complex, did you? They really are. This is what we do, and a lot of times we don't even know what we're doing. We don't know we're doing it. So, how could we possibly not perform such a vital function of life? If we read Matthew 7, verse 1, and stop there, it says, judge not that you be not judged. Taken to an extreme, not to do so would be to drop out of life. We can't function if we don't make these evaluations or judgments. The very quality of life here and now, what we do, absolutely largely depends upon the quality of the decisions we make, based on the judgments we make. The better prepared we are to make a quality judgment, the greater the probability of success that comes out. So, isn't this the underlying purpose of education? Absolutely it is. Learning to make quality judgments ties directly to God's purpose. He shows clearly in such places like Matthew chapter 13. I'm not going to take time to read that. It's 10 through 17. It'd be good for your notes. And I will read 1 Corinthians 2. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 6 through 9. He shows that mankind is blinded to vital elements of his purpose and plan. So we have to do something. Let's take a look, if you will, at 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Starting in verse 6. It says, however, when we speak wisdom among those who are mature, yet not the wisdom of this age, nor of the rulers of this age, who are coming to nothing, but we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom of which God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew. For had they known, they would have not crucified the Lord of glory. And it goes on to say, but as it is written, eyes not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man, the things which God has prepared for those who love him. Think about that. With all this said, salvation, brethren, is impossible until God reveals these things to us. Let's drop down a few verses and continue reading in verse 10. But God has revealed them to us through his Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things. You see what's going on here? We're starting to see evaluation. We're starting to see judgments. For the Spirit searches all things. Yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of a man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God. These things we also speak, not in words which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man does not receive these things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolish to him, nor can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. But he who is spiritual judges all things, yet he himself is rightly judged by no one. For he has known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him. But we have the mind of Christ. At the proper time in each person's life, each one of us, God reveals the missing elements, and then he commands him, us, them, to choose. If we don't make a judgment, we can't choose. To make right choices, a person must judge. Why then do people say that we should not judge? Why do some scriptures give the impression that we are sinning if we judge another person's conduct or attitude? Well, it appears to produce somewhat of a controversy here, somewhat of maybe a division or a contrast that is impossible to resolve, right? It brings up some very good questions. Well, we see that it is imperative to observe the examples of others, as well as our own conduct. Compare them with what? The standards of God, of Jesus Christ. And then choose what we will do based on that process. This is judging. Let me just throw out a few dangers here, though, because we have to be careful with all this. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 here. Notice what Paul writes. He pointed this right out, 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1. He said, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. If we don't know what Christ is, what Christ is looking like, what Christ's actions are, if we can't judge for ourselves what Christ looks like, how can we follow Paul or anybody else for that matter who says they're following Christ? We have to know. Let me just quote this to you. He adds more in Philippians 3, verse 17. He says, brethren, join in following my example and note those who so walk, as you have us for a pattern. And he's saying that based on the fact, he says, follow me as I follow Christ. These verses clearly invite you and I, brethren, as family, as brethren, as fellow members of God, to observe the apostles' conduct, to judge, if you will, if it conforms to the life of Christ, the life that Christ lived, the example that Christ taught. And then we are to choose if we will live that way or not. So to this point, it is clear that we cannot escape our responsibility to judge. Yet, as we read in Matthew 7, verse 1, and Romans 14, 3 brings this out, James 4, verse 11, 12 also brings this out, we are warned about judging one another. So, it is kind of a tricky topic. So, we have to be careful with the problem. Where's the problem? Where's the danger in judging? I mean, I think we're starting to see that it is an act that we are to do. So where's the danger? Well, the danger lies in the quality of our judgments. And consequently, any action that we take on the basis of that judgment. So it does go back on us personally. We have to be very careful here. Notice John chapter 7. John chapter 7, verse 24. And this is where it all comes back to, the type of judgment, the type of judging that we are to do. John 7, verse 24, Jesus commanded us to do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. And that's the key, righteous judgment. Just a few verses earlier, the Jews here, they were watching and they were listening to Christ. And they had judged Christ here at this point to have a demon. You remember that? This was probably one of the most misguided judgments ever in history. Why could they not make a better judgment than that? Well, simply because they were judging by the wrong standard. They could not recognize, and so they could not correctly relate to what true godliness was. Even though Jesus in the flesh was there, it was lived in their presence, and it was taught to them in truth, they couldn't get it. The people of the time were greatly confused about Christ. You drop down to verse 12. John 7, verse 12 says, "And there was much murmuring among the people concerning him." They were confused. They were talking about Christ. Some said, "He is good." Others said, "No. On the contrary, he deceives the people." On another occasion, if you remember a story, I'm not going to turn there, but it's back in Matthew. Christ was talking to his disciples. He said, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" What are they saying about me? What are they talking about? He went on to say that some say John the Baptist, some say you're the coming Elijah, and others say Jeremiah or even one of the other prophets. A lot of confusion went on back then. The people's judgment of Christ was so prejudiced by their carnality that in John, he says that he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. So, could our judgment of people in whom Christ lives also be somewhat distorted because of the carnality that is active in us? That's kind of a personal question, isn't it? We need to think about that. This is part of the equation, though, and it's definitely worth thinking about in our own minds. We may be ill-equipped, if you will, to make a very sound judgment because maybe we are unable to recognize godly character. Not just godly character and qualities in a person, but maybe we can't recognize godly character and qualities, period. Brother, if that's the case, we need to check. We need to look into this. We need to pray. We need to grow in our relationship with God. We need to be on our knees. Or maybe we don't understand the factors involved in another's conduct. That seems to be more prevalent, doesn't it? But judging is still necessary. It's a necessary part of a life of a Christian in God's church. Consider the Apostle Paul's judgment of the man who was openly sinning while fellowshipping with the congregation of the brethren in Corinth. You remember what happened? Let's just go there. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 5. First Corinthians chapter 5, we'll start in verse 3. This is what Paul was recounting here. He said, "For I indeed, as absent in the body, but present in spirit, have already judged, as though I were present, concerning him who has so done this deed. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, when you are gathered together along with my spirit, with the power of our Lord Jesus Christ, delivered such a one to Satan from the destruction of the flesh, that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Christ." Paul not only judged, which means he had to have a little bit of foreknowledge, he had to understand what was going on, he had to make an evaluation. He judged on the basis of the testimony and judgment of others that he trusted. There's the difference. And guess what he did then? We disfellowshipped this man. He did this without hearing the man's own testimony. You know, this kind of goes back to the idea that all of us, anybody, can say things, we can talk a good talk, but what's our fruits? What's the fruit show? God says, I know you by your fruits. This is the same man, Paul here, who wrote in Romans 14, who are you to judge another servant? And then verse 10, he says, but why do you judge your brother? Well, he obviously very strongly believed that when the spiritual and the moral integrity of a congregation was threatened by a blatant sin, judgment was necessary. And that's exactly what was going on there. There are many references to judging in the Old Testament, and in fact, to be a judge in Israel. One told this position had to have great responsibilities. At times in Israel, in their history, judges, they function more like kings and more like governors than what we consider a judge. But just as a reference, you don't have to turn there, but you can write down 2 Chronicles 19 and verse 5 through 9. This talks about Jehoshaphat. If you remember that story, he made a series of reforms in Judah regarding the judging that touched on a New Testament applications. So it's a good lead into this. To summarize it, he charged the judges to, number one, fear God. He told them they need to realize that their judgments were not for man, but for the Lord. So he was working on behalf of God. He also charged the Levites that they were to judge in the fear of the Lord. And to do so, he said, faithfully, and they said, with a perfect heart. Brother, this is very important, considering our calling, what we are here to do, where we want to go next. You know, we want to continue on. We want to be in the kingdom. That is our goal. Revelation 5:10 tells us we will become kings and priests. So you and I will have this same opportunity. But I do want you to notice here, we're in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 2. Look at this direct statement. Paul said this. He says, do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And then he goes on. And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Well, the context here involves settling disputes between church members. Christians, other than the ministry, must judge. Ministry too. But every one of us must judge. And we must learn to judge righteously. And that is the key. We go back to that. We have to learn to judge righteously. Think about this. We have to learn to judge righteously. Would God call us to judge in his kingdom? We just read it in 1 Corinthians. That's what Paul said. And then prohibit us from preparing to do so in our Christian lives? The answer to this lies in understanding the use of judging within its context. I want to turn back to Matthew chapter 7. We've quoted that about 3 or 4 times, but I want to bring some more verses into this now. Matthew chapter 7, starting in verse 1 here, it covers many of the instances where a scripture command you and I not to judge. We read that, Matthew 7, verse 1. It also contains some of the reasons why we should be very careful about what we allow ourselves to do in this regard and how we move forward. Matthew 7, verse 1 says, judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck out of your eye, and look, a plank in your own, there is a plank in your own eye. Then he goes and say, hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. You see the transformation here? He says, judge not, you be not judged. In other words, be careful what we do. And when we decide to start learning this and doing this, make sure it's righteous judgment. We cannot avoid judging. If we were witnesses to a flagrant violation of the law in which innocent people were harmed, could we keep quiet because we're not to judge? Doesn't Christ command us to judge? Now, wait a minute. We just read Matthew 7, verse 1. Well, look at Matthew 7, verse 6. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swines, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces. Do we not have to judge who or what are dogs and swines? Considering verse 15, it says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. Do we not have to judge whether a man is a false minister? Do we not have to reject that teaching? But how do we do that? Based on appraising the fruits, evaluating, judging the fruits. We must take care to understand clearly what Jesus meant, at least in chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, and understand what he was actually saying here. He obviously did not mean we should not judge at all. That's not what he's saying. Within the context of Luke chapter 6, verse 35 through 38, Jesus uses, judge not that you be not judged, to urge us to love our enemies. That's what Luke is talking about, loving our enemies. Be merciful, be forgiving, be generous. This very greatly modifies now, when you understand the rest of it, Matthew 7's account, showing that judge not is not saying don't judge, it's a warning. It's a warning against self-righteous judging. It's a warning against being too severe on our brothers and sisters. It's a warning of having a sharp tongue criticism. It's a warning of condemnation. We are in no way at all to condemn each other. Judging is deciding whether you like their actions or you don't. Their actions are godly or they're not. Condemning is when you sentence them to death or thereabouts. That's where you cross the line. That's where we cross the line. This is not a command to be absolutely neutral and tolerant regarding moral issues. But it is a warning. It's a strong warning to be very careful and very, very loving when we do judge, when we do evaluate based on fruits. Now, we can apply this admonition to James chapter 4, verse 11 and 12, and Romans 14, verses 10 through 13. That's where we are reminded, if you know the story, if you remember the story, it's about judging our brother or showing contempt. And the fact that we will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. So there are practical reasons why Jesus would advise us about this. And of probably the most prime importance is that even though it is important that we judge rightly, it is even more important that we do not usurp the place of God. And that goes on to condemning. It's not for us to do. God says, vengeance is mine. He will take care of all that. Turn with me to Romans chapter 14, verse 4. Romans 14 and verse 4. He says this, "Who are you to judge another servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand." Paul here begins this letter to the Romans, calling himself a servant of Christ. And he reminds all of us that we are his servants. Verses 7 through 8 talks about that. Think about this. A servant does not have the same rights and responsibilities as a master. Even though we are permitted the right of making an appraisal, an evaluation of a person's conduct, we are not permitted the right to pass that judgment on a fellow servant. In other words, we don't do the condemnation. That's up to God. We can caution. We can say, hey, you know, listen, I don't know if I do that or not. You know, maybe there's all kinds of ways to go about that. The point is, we don't cross that line. We don't put somebody down. A fellow servant does not stand or fall at the bar of you and I's judgment. The only judgment that matters is the final judgment of all of our mutual master, and that's God the Father. If he is satisfied or displeased, brethren, he will act, and he will act in his time, and he will act in his way. Now, this is in no way means that we cannot approach a brother or a sister or to inquire about the understanding of us in his conduct or her conduct so that we might know whether our appraisal is correct or not. You know, in other words, we have that right. You know, the bottom line is we are our brother's keeper. So we have that right. We have that responsibility. But we have to do it in a righteous manner. Assuming, of course, that our intent in questioning him or her is for his own good or their own good, why would we even approach him? Why would we do this? Would it not be because maybe our evaluation of their conduct led us to judge them and led us to question whether they are in serious moral or spiritual trouble? Brother, this is where we're graduating to. As we grow in Christianity, as we grow in our relationship with God, these are part of our responsibilities. God encourages us to do this. Go back to James chapter 5. Go forward, I should say. James chapter 5. God encourages us here in James chapter 5, verse 19. He says this, "Brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his ways will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." How can we do this if we don't evaluate the character or the fruits of our fellow brethren? And don't leave yourself out. You know, we talked about self-evaluation for a long time. This is not a topic of self-evaluation today, but we can't leave that part out either. Back up to Galatians chapter 6, it's even a little more explicit. Galatians chapter 6, verse 1 and 2. This is pretty much a command for us that we have to do something. He says here in verse 1, "Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, any sin, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness." That's being righteous. "Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted." That means do it carefully. You know, if don't get in over your head, but nevertheless, we are to do this. It says, "Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." You know, these verses complement and further, I think, refine our understanding now of Matthew 7, verses 1 through 5. We cannot help but judge, and we have a responsibility to be our brother's keeper, as we already said. But we also have a responsibility to be keenly aware of our own weaknesses and flaws. That's a warning right there in Galatians 6, verses 1 and 2. Before we ever begin to think about the depths, the extent, and maybe the intensity of the fault of our brethren. In other words, we better be right with God before we take on this other responsibility. But that's what we're supposed to be working towards. But keep in mind, Jesus warned us that we will receive the same kind of judgment that we make on others. That's back in Matthew chapter 7. We read this already. We read Matthew 7, verse 2. But just think about this, brethren. Do we really want that? That warning ought to sober any thinking person. Do we really believe God when he gives us such a stern warning as this? Jesus adds another warning here, though. He says our judgment may be distorted because we may have a flaw of far greater magnitude in us than the flaw that we observe so critically in our brother or sister. I hope we never forget that. The unspoken inference here is that because the flaw is ours and we love ourselves, we are willing to be very, very lenient in our own self-judgment. And we talked about this again, a few months back. By focusing our criticism on others, it enables us to avoid scrutinizing ourselves. And that is wrong. That is not what we're supposed to be doing. Some enjoy correcting others, and they do this for very many, many reasons. It makes them feel virtuous. It makes them feel compensating for their failures. There's all kinds of things that it does for a person, but they're not right. The judgments that we make about others is in reality the judgments that we will receive from God. Think about that. Do we want righteous judgment from God? Then we better extend righteous judgment to others. This is very similar to what Paul's teaching in Corinthians to his church in Corinth about their careless and profane observance at Passover. We mentioned that a couple times. Let's go back here to 1 Corinthians chapter 11 again. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. We'll start in verse 28 through 31. This is what Paul writes. He says, "But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. For if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged." If we would take the time before being critical of our fellow brethren, of anybody for that matter, to examine ourselves again, and again, do it by the standards of Christ, by the standards Christ said, we would probably see so many flaws in ourselves that we would probably, if we're being honest, we'd probably be shamed and would probably be humbled into approaching our brethren in a very right spirit, not a just speak now and think later. We shouldn't be doing that. So why might our judgment be out of proportion? Well, there's several reasons, but just a couple I'll throw at you is one reason is that we never can know all the facts of the whole person. No matter how hard we try, humanly, our experience, our oversight, our understandings is limited. We must learn to avoid making the kinds of judgments spectators make at a sporting event. We've all seen it, and maybe we've done it. The fact that we could be a fan sitting 100 yards away from the playing field, we're very, very quick to say, "Well, that referee, that umpire, that made the worst call in the world." We weren't there. We don't know what happened. We have to be careful of this. I used to ref YOU ball back when YOU ball was extremely competitive. I quit. Well, it wasn't the players. It was the parents. The parents. And it's no different today. I mean, in the outside world, we go to games as Ethan would be in sports. We'd go to games. And it was embarrassing sitting in the stands because the parents are crazy. So it's surprising they didn't clear the gymnasium several times. But that's what we're talking about here. We can never know the whole story. The fact is, brethren, we never see the whole picture as God does. And we have to keep that in mind. And it's exceedingly difficult to know a person's intention or his strengths and weaknesses. Everybody has difference. Another reason, and it's kind of an overlapping reason here, is that it's almost impossible for us to make an impartial judgment. As a result of our experience, we have built-in biases. You believe that? We have built-in biases that they absolutely color or maybe haze a little bit of fog our judgments. Go over to John chapter 8. John chapter 8, verse 12. Read a few verses here. 12 through 16. Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. The Pharisees therefore said to him, You bear witness of yourself. Your witness is not true. Wow, can you imagine this? Jesus answered and said to them, Even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true, for I know where I come from and where I'm going. But you do not know where I come from or where I'm going. You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. And yet, if I do judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone, but I am with the Father who sent me. The Pharisees here, they misjudged Christ because they had many of the same limitations that you and I do, brethren. They judged according to the flesh. That is, as others have translated in this phrase, according to the flesh, they judge by material standards. Goodspeed commentary says that. Moffat says, by the outside. And then the Knox commentary says, after your earthly fashions. Well, these are not what we're supposed to be basing our judgments off of. But even Jesus, though he was qualified to do so, verse 16 here, he says that he was not judging anyone. He imposed the same limitations on himself that he imposed on his followers in Matthew 7, verse 1. Judgment and judging is a big topic, and there's much more to say about it. Christ appraised situations, and where it was necessary, he corrected others. But even he, qualified as he was, he never stepped across the line to condemn. He never used his authority to put someone down or even lord it over him, if you will. And we have to follow that same example. We have to be very, very careful. Judgment is a tool, but it has to be righteous judgment. It can't be judgment off the fly. You know, you see someone do something and we immediately get mad or angry and then we make a judgment. That's not what we should be doing. When and only when we practice godly righteous judgment, then we are doing what God has instructed us to do. As we close here, let me just give you four quick one-liners, if you will, to wrap this up. And I think they're critical. There's probably more than this, but here's four of them. Number one, we must take care not to spend our rights as a fellow servant. Step beyond our rights as a fellow servant. In other words, our rights extend only as far as being a brother and a servant, not a master, because we are not the master. Number two, we must correct for the right reason. our intent must be one of deep respect and love for the other. In other words, we want to see each other grow spiritually and grow together. And that should be the only reason. Number three, we must have a godly attitude. We must be humble, considering our own weaknesses and limitations. Goes back to, you know, self-evaluation before we evaluate somebody else. And finally, number four, we must correct in kindness and gentleness. Remember that we are trying to heal a spiritual wound, and we are absolutely not trying to rub salt in it. So think about this topic, brethren. It takes a person of considerable spiritual growth to do this and do it well. And I hope and pray that we all are on that track, and we all are growing, and that's where we need to be. So yes, we must judge, but we must learn to be loving in that judgment. We must learn to be very thoughtful and very considerate and understand the standards of God's word as we do this. Understand the family of God and absolutely only judge with righteous judgment.